Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, this week marks the 459th anniversary of the founding of St. Augustine on September 8, 1565.
Father Francisco Lopez, the fleet chaplain, soon to be first pastor of the first parish, came ashore ahead of Pedro Menendez Aviles, the leader of the founding expedition, and then went forward to meet Menendez holding a cross.
We'll discuss Florida banking pioneers William Barnett and Sons.
William B. Barnett arrived in Jacksonville only a few weeks before he established the Bank of Jacksonville, a town that already hosted three of the five banks to be found in the entire state.
And we'll talk about the effort to identify Native Americans buried in St. Augustine National Cemetery. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. This week marks the 459th anniversary of the founding of St. Augustine, the oldest continuously occupied European settlement in what would become the United States. Eminent Florida historian and author Michael Gannon was formerly a Catholic priest. He was working in St. Augustine in the early 1960s as the town was preparing to commemorate their 400th anniversary. Dr. Gannon died in April 2017, but we spoke with him in 2015 as St. Augustine was preparing to recognize their 450th anniversary.
There were a number of individual and institutional contributions to the 400th anniversary. And then there was a citywide coordinating committee that oversaw a lot of other activity collectively. As far as the Catholic Church is concerned, there were two major products of our efforts. I say I, being a priest historian with the Diocese of St. Augustine at the time. First, at the Old Mission, where the first parish mass was celebrated on September 8, 1565. It was decided to build a cross because that was central to the original ceremony where Father Francisco Lopez, the fleet chaplain, soon to be first pastor of the first parish, came ashore ahead of Pedro Menendez Aviles, the leader of the founding expedition, and then went forward to meet Menendez holding a cross. And Menendez came on land, knelt, and kissed the cross. And so Archbishop Joseph P. Hurley of the Diocese of St. Augustine thought it best to highlight the church's contribution by the erection of a very large cross. And ultimately, it was constructed of stainless steel and rose to a height of 208 feet. I think it is still the tallest freestanding cross in the Western Hemisphere. And I think it's very impressive. It's stately. It has a wonderful design that was done by an architectural firm in Boston, Massachusetts. It can be seen 14 miles out to sea, and it's grown among and upon the people who live in this community and has become a symbol of the first mission to the North American natives and the first parish erected by Europeans in this country.
Also part of St. Augustine's 400th anniversary was the construction of a contemporary church called the Prince of Peace and a bridge linking the church with the historic mission grounds. Plans were made for a library and research center on the property, but funding was not available. Today, visitors to the mission site can also see the statue of Father Francisco Lopez.
That statue was erected in the 1950s. It was executed by a distinguished Yugoslav sculptor, Ivan Mestrovich. But it was placed in a copse of trees where it did not stand out against a dark background. And the plan that the architects in 1965 came forward with was to move it to a site on open ground where the figure of Father Lopez with his arms in the air would stand out against the sky. And now, at long last, the statue has been moved to that space, and you can see the dramatic difference in the figure of Father Lopez as he's seen completely and clearly now against the sky, and directly in front of the cross, which stands behind him.
As the Spanish began exploring and colonizing Florida, the Reformation movement was underway in Europe. Martin Luther, John Calvin, Henry VIII, and other Reformation leaders were protesting various practices of the Catholic Church and forming Protestant religions. In an effort to maintain its power and influence, the Catholic Church launched the Counter-Reformation. Part of that effort was to send Catholic missionaries around the world, including the New World of Florida. Michael Gannon explains that Spanish imperialism and Catholicism were inextricably linked.
The two efforts were coterminous. Everywhere Spain moved politically and economically and militarily, the church moved too. The church was always a partner of Spanish expansion. And indeed, some of the great expansion of the church through her mission system preceded the advance of other elements of Spanish society. And you can certainly see that in the interior missions of Florida during the 17th century, where missions stood out in the wilderness, apart from all of the other examples of Spanish colonial existence. And the friars of the Franciscan order lived very lonely lives servicing their people. So the church was in the forefront. If you want to select any part of the Spanish cultural presence in Florida and the rest of the Spanish provinces of North America, you would have to say the church was in advance of all other institutions.
St. Augustine is the site of the first Christian church in what would become the United States. As Michael Gannon points out, St. Augustine is also the site of our country's first school, first hospital, first court of law, first market, and first city plan. As the Franciscan missionaries tried to convert the Timucuan Indians who inhabited the region, they discovered that the natives had no written language. A friar named Francisco Pereja developed a phonetic written version of the Timucuan language, preserving it for us today. Although the Timucuan people no longer exist, Michael Gannon brings their language to life by reciting the first sentences of the Lord's Prayer.
Heka itamile numa hiban tema bisa milanema abak wano leta habema balunu nane mima noho boni habe.
A bronze plaque at the mission site in St. Augustine shows the locations of dozens of missions scattered throughout Florida and the southeastern portion of North America. The attempts to convert Florida's indigenous peoples met with varied results.
The natives were both welcoming and hostile, depending on the tribe. When the first missionary to attempt a pacifist approach to the natives, he being a Dominican friar who landed at Tampa Bay, the Indians were extremely hostile. They killed him at once. And prior to that, when a number of Franciscan friars and secular priests came with the second expedition of Juan Ponce de Leon to Florida in 1521 on the lower Gulf Coast, they were attacked by the Calusa natives of the site and driven back into the sea. So it depends. In most other particulars, the native peoples were welcoming, particularly in northern Florida. And that's where the Franciscans had their great successes when they came here beginning in 1573 and built missions up the Atlantic coast as far as the border between Georgia and South Carolina. And in the early 17th century, they moved westward across the peninsula and were generally welcome wherever they went, and created their greatest number of missions up around the Appalachian country, centered on present-day Tallahassee. Those natives had been very hostile to earlier Spanish expeditions in the first half of the 16th century. But in the mission century, they were very accommodating and welcoming to the Franciscan friars. So it depends. On balance, the natives welcomed the Christian religion and its principal exponents, the Franciscans.
Renowned Florida historian Michael Gannon died in April 2017. We spoke with him in 2015. This week marks the 459th anniversary of the founding of St. Augustine, the oldest continuously occupied European settlement in what would become the United States. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime at myfloridahistory.org, where you can register for the 2025 Caribbean Conference Cruise presented by the Florida Historical Society and the Zora Neale Hurston Festival of the Arts and Humanities. More information at myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, there was a time not long ago when banks demonstrated their reliability and security with sturdy buildings that displayed lots of marble and solemn-faced employees. Today's banks use advertising to promote visions of happy customers engaging with friendly bank employees inside buildings that are light and airy. However, most people conduct their banking online and never or seldom interact with a bank employee.
Banking has changed enormously in less than half a century. David J. Genzel, at the time of publication, an independent scholar from Jacksonville, takes us back to the early days of banking in Florida in his article on the Barnett family, published in the summer 2000 issue of the Florida Historical Quarterly. First established as the Bank of Jacksonville in 1877, the Barnett Banks Incorporated finally came to an end in 1998 when Nations Bank acquired its assets. For 120 years, five generations of Barnetts built and sustained a financial institution that, by the time of its demise, operated more than 600 offices across Florida, with assets totaling $44 billion. Opening with a capital investment of $43,000, William B. Barnett and his sons became banking leaders in the early years of the state's economic growth. Hal Barnett acquired the capital to found what quickly became the deposit bank for state funds and an important, if often little noticed, actor in state and national development projects is a story worth hearing. Genzel's narration of the banking house illustrates both the opportunities available to men like William Barnett and the importance of character in the volatile world of banking and finance in turn-of-the-century Florida. William B. Barnett arrived in Jacksonville only a few weeks before he established the Bank of Jacksonville, a town that already hosted three of the five banks to be found in the entire state. Banking was a risky business, and it seems improbable that men would trust their money to someone they did not know. Barnett's oldest son, Will, operated a furniture store in the town, but he had only lived in Jacksonville a few years, not enough time to establish a reputation of trustworthiness, one would think. And yet, people seemingly trusted William Barnett his whole life. Born in 1824 to a modestly prosperous family, William left school to apprentice himself to a saddle and harness maker after his father lost everything in a deal gone bad. In 1858, Barnett moved his wife Sarah and their two children to Hiawatha, Kansas, a village of, quote, a half dozen frame houses and a country store. Barnett bought the store and a number of parcels of land. He did not fight for either side in the Civil War, but did become involved in local politics and supported the construction of a rail line through the town. In 1870, he formed Barnett, Merrill & Company, a private bank. His move to Florida came shortly after a visit with his son, Will, who lived in Jacksonville. The decision to relocate may have been an effort to improve the health of Sarah. The sale of the store, land, and bank in Hiawatha provided the capital for establishing the Bank of Jacksonville.
Connie, Barnett sounds like an astute businessman, always at the right place at the right time, with enough capital to invest in the next moneymaker.
He was, but Barnett was a man of principles. His portrait, which is included in the article, shows a stern man who you would expect to be honest and upright in his dealings. According to Genzel, he gave his son Byron 5 business rules to follow, which the son remembered more than 50 years later. Barnett's rules included an admonition to live by the golden rule, a warning against doing business at a loss, encouragement to support young men of promise, regardless of their initial station in life, a caution against making promises you cannot keep, and finally an assurance that, quote, if you watch your expense account and your losses, your profits will take care of themselves, end quote. Barnett opened his bank as a private bank, which meant the institution did not fall under state incorporation or federal banking laws. In essence, it was a private company for providing capital for projects favored by the owners and shareholders. The bank attracted depositors and made its first loan on its first day. The Bank of Jacksonville was robbed during its first year of operation. One of the robbers was caught, but the $7,500 they stole was never recovered. Nevertheless, by 1880, the fortunes of the Barnetts and the bank became intimately tied to local and state politics.
Connie, how did a Yankee from the much-reviled state of Kansas manage to become a major player in Florida's turn-of-the-century economic development?
A marriage, an election, and Hamilton Diston all played roles in the elevation of the Jacksonville Bank to state and national prominence. The Barnetts kept a low profile regarding their Yankee status, but became a part of the city's elite when in 1880, Byron married Caroline Hallows Lingle, a descendant of Francis Philip Fascio. Lina Barnett brought her husband and his family into the elite social and civic circles of Jacksonville. One of Lina's cousins, Henry Lingle, was the tax collector for Duval County. The Bank of Jacksonville offered the county a better deal on their deposits that would save money, and Lingle transferred the county's tax accounts to the Barnett Bank. The following year, newly elected Governor William Bloxam appointed Henry Lingle state treasurer, and the state accounts were moved to the Bank of Jacksonville. As Genzel explains, quote, the bank's new role as state depository coincided with the Diston land purchase, a watershed event in Florida's history that ushered in a period of prosperity, end quote. Diston purchased 4 million acres of land from the Florida Internal Improvement Fund for 25 cents per acre. He sold half the land to English shipbuilder Sir Edward Reed. The Bank of Jacksonville loaned the money Reed needed to complete the deal. As Byron Barnett recalled, quote, Reed was slow in paying us, and it was only after we had notified him we were going to enforce our lien on the collateral that he raised the money in New York, end quote. Although Diston's scheme led to his financial ruin, the land purchase initiated a development boom that included the construction of railroads that linked the citrus producers to markets, spurred winter tourism, and encouraged urban development. In 1888, the Bank of Jacksonville received a national charter and became the National Bank of Jacksonville. 2 years later, the bank moved into a new stone building at the corner of Bay and Laura Streets. The bank weathered multiple crises that destroyed less well-managed financial institutions. The yellow fever epidemic of 1888, the phosphate speculation boom of the 1890s, that destroyed 2 national banks and crippled a third in Jacksonville alone. The national panic of 1893, the citrus freeze of 1894-95, and the Jacksonville fire of 1901. The National Bank of Jacksonville survived the fire intact and offered space in their vault for other banks to store their safes until they could rebuild. As Genzel concludes, the conservative fiscal policies practiced by the Barnetts and their reputation local and statewide for honesty and integrity sustained their banking house for over 120 years and benefited both the city of Jacksonville and the state of Florida.
I believe I had an account at Barnett Bank in Orlando in the 1990s. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. Sebastian Garcia has this report on the effort to identify Native Americans buried in St. Augustine National Cemetery.
Dr. Amy Giroux is the Associate Director of the Center for Humanities and Digital Research at the University of Central Florida. She is also a co-principal investigator and the technical lead for the UCF Veterans Legacy Program, VLP. I spoke with Dr. Giroux during the 2024 UCF VLP Institute about her multifaceted research at St. Augustine National Cemetery. One of her many research projects at St. Augustine National Cemetery focused on identifying those buried with an unmarked grave that read, quote, six unknown Indians, end quote. These Native Americans were brought to St. Augustine as prisoners from a larger conflict between the U.S. Army and Native American tribes known as the Red River War.
In 1874, the Army declared war on a lot of the Plains tribes. It wound up being called the Red River War. And the intent of the U.S. Army was to get all of the Plains Indians to live within the reservations. And the Army felt that the only way that they would get folks to cooperate was to essentially take all their leaders and imprison them somewhere. So they took 72 prisoners out in Indian territory at the time. It was in Oklahoma in the present day. And they shackled them, ankles, wrists. They stayed 9 days at Fort Leavenworth while the government finished the orders for Richard Henry Pratt to take charge of the prisoners and bring them to what was called Fort Marion here in St. Augustine, which is present-day Castillo. So the 72 wound up coming to St. Augustine in May of 1875. Some of the paperwork I've read, some of the reports I've read said it was supposed to be a short-term incarceration, like 6 months or something. Other things I've read, it was supposed to be longer. It wound up being 3 years. They were here from 1875 to 1878. And while they were here, they made the newspaper. There was an article very early on that said, you know, the spectacle of Indians in St. Augustine, and the tourists would come in and gawk at them and see them at the fort and things. But this one article early in May, the Kiowa chief's son died of disease here in St. Augustine within like 2 or 3 days of their arrival. And the newspaper article talked about four Army privates carrying his coffin down to the southeast corner of the post cemetery and burying him there.
Indeed, primary sources such as newspaper accounts, ledger art drawings from Native Americans, and the papers of Richard Henry Pratt assisted Dr. Giroux in appropriately identifying which Native Americans were forcibly taken to St. Augustine and later buried at the National Cemetery.
The first indication, you know, I saw those grave sites. It puzzled me, you know, why were Native Americans buried in this cemetery? And I honestly kind of stumbled upon the fact that though Plains prisoners were brought here, I actually got into that level of it because I found ledger drawings online. And I wanted to understand why they were here, why they were, you know, drawing these images. So I started investigating those, and to get the background information on it and try to understand, you know, who they were, I had to resort to newspapers a lot. I needed to look at records that are at the National Archives in D.C. There's a lot of records that were created by Richard Henry Pratt during that time period. And in that correspondence, there are messages and letters that were sent to the Adjutant General's office that said, "It's my honor to inform you that heap of birds died on such and such a day." And those were the paper records that told me the specifics of when each of these prisoners had died here. And, you know, it added to some of the things I had found in the newspapers. But those were the documents, Pratt's papers, where I found the names of the dead.
Dr. Giroux's unprecedented research has resulted in her directly engaging with several of the tribes whose ancestors were those indigenous people who were imprisoned at the Castillo, buried at St. Augustine National Cemetery, and dishonored by labeling such individuals as quote-unquote unknown.
In August of 2022, the National Park Service actually reached out to me. Steve Roberts is the director of education and interpretation at the Castillo. And he said, "From what I understand, you know where the Plains Indian prisoners are buried?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, the Cheyenne and Arapaho would like to talk to you." And I was like, "Okay." So I was invited to meetings in August of that year, and I met with the governor of the Cheyenne and Arapaho and a number of their representatives. And I shared what I knew, which some of the things that I shared with them, the governor said, "Oh, I didn't know that." You know, and I told others things that I knew, and he's like, "Didn't know that either." So, you know, I'm sharing my knowledge with them. Of course, mine is from the knowledge I've gained from the Army perspective. And they're teaching me their oral histories about the prisoners who were here. So in November of 2022, we had a two-day symposium with Flagler College, National Park Service, the Cheyenne and Arapaho Tribe, and some of my UCF colleagues and I, and taught Flagler students, some UCF students, the public about that incarceration. And then this past year, all five tribes had representatives here in St. Augustine for another two-day series of ceremonies. And that one, the Kiowa women danced inside the fort, and they honored their ancestors in that way. So it's been very emotional. It's roller coaster kind of thing, but I'm definitely very honored to be able to work with them.
To learn more about Dr. Giroux's groundbreaking research at St. Augustine National Cemetery, please listen to episode 1 of the 2024 UCF VOP podcast series, releasing later this fall, wherever you get your podcast. For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS media production assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. You can also listen as a podcast or find us anytime at myfloridahistory.org. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.